change really impacts our brain in a negative way because we don't know and we can't predict who we are going to be and what's going to happen on the other side of the change. So what if we, as the people who are guiding the change, helped people talk through that resistance, that fear, and help them put words to it so not only can they understand it, but we can understand them?
This is Bridging the Gap with your host, Matt Reiner.
Mary Schmid, welcome to Bridging the Gap. How are you?
I'm well, Matt. Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here with you.
Oh, this is going to be a blast. This is an area that I love to geek out on. Brain science, neuroscience, all of it. How the mind works, how psychology impacts decisions we make, why we do certain things. You know, our team is actually about to do an innovation lab all around behavioral finance. So this stuff is my jam, and I love talking about it. So I'm hopefully and knowingly going to learn something really great from you in this conversation. So I'm excited to get there. But you're an author, you're an entrepreneur, you started your consulting business, you're in neuroscience. I always like to get to know our guests, you know, just through asking one simple question. And that's, sure. You know, what did the 13-year-old Mary Schmid want to be when she grew up?
You know what? The 13-year-old could think of nothing but getting off the farm and moving to the big city. And when she moved to the big city, she was going to be singing or dancing or performing. She was going to be on stage. Well, I did. I headed off to my first year in college. I joined the theater club and I spent the first quarter in a gunny sack in a dusty theater. And I thought, this is not what I signed up for. So sort of like Goldilocks, always figuring these next things out. My 13-year-old have led me down this road of many different things at many different points in time. It's always trying to find what's the right fit. So off I went to nursing school and that was good. Well, I lasted there about 3 or 4 months, and I simply said, there's got to be more. Went off and got my master's degree in education and administration. Taught at the university for a couple of years. That was good, Matt. But what about this administrative thing? Well, I don't know. So I went and tried that. That was really good. And then I thought one day, I walked past this board meeting where there were primarily men making the decisions, financial decisions about the programs and services that they're going to support. And I thought to myself, why am I not in there? Why am I not? Well, off I went and I got my MBA. I got my MBA and then off I went to be a senior executive director, a senior leader at the university. And that was good. It was combining all the skills that I had until that one day when I thought, you know, some people are really easy to talk to and get along with. And I'm talking about world-renowned surgeons that lecture across the world, that write textbooks, but some of them are so easy to get along with. And some, you know, quite honestly, I would just as soon avoid. Why? Well, people would say, you know, just keep talking. They'll come around, yada, yada, the same old that we've heard. And I said, no, there's got to be more to it. So off I went to simply say, why do we connect easily with some people and some people not at all? And that's where I discovered what we're going to talk about today. And that's the neuroscience of conversations. What brain is critical to our ability to connect, navigate, and grow with each other. So that's good, man. Now I think I've really arrived. This is really good. And so I'm teaching CEOs how to do this. And one day a financial planner came to me and said, I think I want to do the work. Well, I thought to myself, you know, I had a couple experiences that were less than stellar with financial advisors, right? So I thought, well, okay, this time he's paying the bill. So I took him on. And what I discovered was he really did care. He was a really good human being and he got really good at conversations. Well, of course he did. I was his teacher, right? But more importantly, we did a real play one day and I thought, oh my gosh, he really is getting this stuff. And so a skeptic, even a skeptic of me, of the financial world, soon became a convert and simply said, you know, I want to work with you. And I thought if that power of a conversation could influence me in such a positive way that even me, the skeptic, would change my ways, what would happen if we began teaching this more and more? So I worked with the firm and we taught the whole staff how to lead the conversations that build trust. And as a result of that, we wrote the book, Make or Break Conversations. They were major contributors because a lot of what I wrote about is exactly the things that I taught them. And so that one thing led to the next thing. I think I finally landed, you know, because in conversations, every conversation has a power to either connect us and build trust or tear us down and shut us down into protection and distrust.
Yeah, I love that journey. And I think it's an exploration of, you know, through experience that's led you to where you are, right? Just taking the next step, taking the next action from there. And I think that that's so powerful. Too often we try to accelerate where we should be, or that we should be somewhere further than we are. And it gets us out of the present from that standpoint. I think behavioral psychology, behavioral finance, the brain, neuroscience, all of it is really kind of gaining some steam and prevalence inside of our industry, because we are dealing with people. Firms are trying to figure out how to differentiate themselves. And our true differentiator is us as individuals and the relationships that we build, which then builds into psychology. And so everybody's investing in it. But I think it'd be good for some individuals or some listeners that may just be entering into this kind of arena. Let's just start by breaking down what is, and I love how you refer to it as brain science, which it is, and that's, I think, a great word. What is brain science?
So brain science is simply understanding the way our brain responds. And in my special little world, how our brain responds in conversations. Let me give you an example. Think about a time you had a good conversation, like a good one. Got that?
Right now. Right now, I'm having a great one.
So in that conference, there was that moment that something good happened, right? Something good happened. You felt safe. You felt secure. You wanted to talk. We went back and forth. We were open. We were having fun. There's no judgment, no criticism. We're simply having a conversation. But what we don't see, Matt, that I teach about, is the invisible activity that goes on in our brain. So what really happens is when we're talking back and forth and we're engaging with one another, our brain gets flooded with oxytocin. Covered with oxytocin, which opens up our prefrontal cortex. You know, some people call it the Einstein brain or the executive brain. It opens up our brain so that we can think, problem solve, create, develop relationships, and that's where trust comes from. Now, think about a very different conversation, one that didn't go so well. In that conversation was that moment, something was said. Maybe it was the way that the person looked at you. Maybe they've reminded you of someone that you're not particularly fond of. Maybe they weren't listening to you. There could be any sorts of things, but there was something that just, I say, rubbed you the wrong way. Your brain automatically responds, gets triggered, covers the brain with cortisol, and you can't even think straight. All you can think about is protecting yourself and staying safe. And the important thing about that is when we're overrun by cortisol, or the amygdala hijack, as some will call it, it shuts off access to our smart brain. So if we're going to lead conversations that build trust, we have to calm down the limbic system and say things that are going to promote the flow of oxytocin. That's brain science.
So that kind of dives into my next kind of stepping stone, right? I want to build on this. I feel when I was doing the research, I was like, this is somewhat like a lecture, right? We're just building on every step of it. So we're talking about the limbic system. We're talking about oxytocin. We're talking about that being like some of the core principles. So if you were to distill into maybe the top 3 to 5 aspects of the core principles of effectively leveraging the benefits of brain science, what would it be? We have to get into the limbic system, right, is what you're saying. So what are some of the core principles in order to turn that on, right? For those that aren't brain science experts or understanding of the full build of the brain, what are some of the ways that we can turn that on and enter that stage?
Yeah, the first thing is you've got to create safety at every conversation. Without safety, there is nothing. And how do you create that safety?
Trust
is the result of how you, trust is always the result, but how do you set it up? You set it up by being really clear about the context and the content. Why are we meeting and what are we going to be talking about? You know, our brain loves certainty. And when we give it the roadmap of what we're going to be talking about, it creates safety. Safety feels good. It opens up the brain. So simple. It seems really simple, but it's really critical. Here's what we're going to talk about. Why are we meeting and what are we going to talk about? The two questions. And once we answer that, people can calm and relax.
When you talk with advisors, I think that seems so simple. It's simple to understand. I think that it's one of those things Unfortunately, it seems simple to understand, and I think it's simple to do, but for some reason, there's this gap where advisors may not be doing that. What is the challenge, or where do you see advisors, or what is the cause? You can go any of those directions for where advisors struggle with that aspect of it, which then, because to your point, right, when we understand what we're about to get ourselves into, we feel more comfortable about it. We can build up this story and this narrative in our mind. And right. you think about people coming into financial advisors' offices, especially prospects, and sometimes even clients, even if they've been a client of yours for a period of time, but it's usually early on, you know, they don't know what has happened and what does it mean for them. And there's a fear, and the fear, to your point, closes up the ability to have this openness, which then makes it become defensive and worried and emotions. And once emotions get involved, we all know that things go to the hell in a handbasket. But where are advisors falling short, or what can advisors do better at, based on your experiences, to accomplish what you just mentioned with clear and about the context and the content of the upcoming conversation?
I have a couple of thoughts about that I'd be delighted to share. Number one, I think advisors simply don't do it because it's too simple and it's too easy. And it is. But the second piece of it, it's so simple and it's so easy that they discount the impact that it creates. Mm-hmm. And number two, that they discount and don't believe that we need to develop, that they need to change some of their patterns of the way that they communicate, because the way that they've done things have been okay. Mm. Because what when I teach about the neuroscience, I break it down to simple things that you can do. They're simple, but they're effective, but you have to do them. And so you have to develop a different way of leading your conversation, not just scripts and tips, but a different process of how you lead your conversation, so that you, for yourself, create in your head a conversational roadmap, your conversational operating system, that at any point in time, you can call upon that and you don't have to worry about what am I going to say next. One of the things, Matt, that I teach my advisors is you have to prepare yourself. Well, we do. We spend hours preparing all of our documents and our slides and our software and our presentation. I said, but the most important thing to prepare is to prepare your internal conversation that you're having with yourself before the conversation. Take 2 minutes. Quiet it down. Breathe. Quiet your nervous system down. Think about the purpose of the conversation that you're about to have with this person, and then flip the script and think about them. What's going on in their world? What's important to them? Mm-hmm. What's to sit in front of you?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you want them to feel as the result of the conversation that you've had? You see, if you take that 2-minute drill, you've effectively removed you as a center of attention and began focusing on the person that you're going to meet that's in front of you. You've effectively turned on your own oxytocin so that when you go and meet them, you have a calm presence. And a calm presence is important because I read your emotions and I read your physical energy in less than a second, and I make a decision if you're a friend or a foe. And so when you approach me with this calm presence, calm confidence, smile, warm eyes, open shoulder and relax, you automatically send me the message that you're my friend. I don't have to fear you.
I love that perspective. I love the idea that it's so simple and easy that we discount it. And that is true in a lot of things in life. Some of the simplest things are the most impactful things, but we just take them for granted and we disregard it. But I think that also when we look at what we do to prepare for a meeting, we put so much emphasis on the meeting itself and making the meeting engaging, effective, useful, efficient, all of it, right? Valuable. That there is an impact, and we don't realize it when we see it like with a sporting event or a play or whatever it may be. There's a lot that goes in pre-event so that you get comfortable when you get there. They send you the parking directions, where to go park so that you can understand it. They send you some insight and information on the play. Like you get teased on it. And there's a purpose behind that. Because mm-hmm. they're putting themselves into their viewers' or their spectators' shoes. And advisors should do that as well. We shouldn't take for granted that our clients are going to come in with the same mindset that we are. And they're likely not going to put in the same amount of work to get prepared for it as we are. And thus, we need to help guide them. And so it's almost a call to the entire community. And I think that there are some advisors out there that do this extremely well, and rightfully so. But I think that there's an opportunity for many advisors to put as much emphasis that they put in the meeting to put into the pre-meeting to help get your client's headspace and mindset in the right space for us to have a great quality meeting.
Right. Exactly. I agree. There's so much that goes on behind the scenes that when it's showtime, you are so calm and so relaxed that all you can focus on is the person that's in front of you. And this is true, whether it's your clients or your team or your loved ones, that you can have this laser sharp focus, because that's the most important thing right now, is that you are in the conversation with them. Not sitting on the bleachers cheering, you're in the conversation with them and can really be present to what it is that they're saying and respond appropriately. Because you're right, when your clients come in, and I don't care, man, if it's your first conversation or your 50th, there is always that sense of angst. Like, what are they really going to talk about? Is the other shoe going to drop? There is always that sort of, it's a fear, and that fear can distract people from being focused and attended to us. So what we need to do is in the immediate, the first few seconds, is grab their attention. Not only pay them, give them our attention, but grab their attention. And how do we do that? With what I call the $1 million opener. And so we present to them, and they're in front of us, and we're relaxed, and we calm. We simply, you know, stop the sports score and the weather. I've got an app for that. But instead, start with a personal connection, an emotional connection. And it's as simple as that. I'm really happy to see you. I've been looking forward to spending time with you. And then pause and let it land.
Yeah, so simple and so impactful. You know, and if you can make it authentic, then it lands drastically, right? Where your mindset before you go out there, you make that authentic. You know, I think a lot of what we're talking about here, and I want to get back to it in a second, but I want to go down a tangent for a second, because the thing that engages my curiosity so much right now is this idea of change. Mm-hmm. How do we encourage people to change, right? We know all this information. We have access to all this information more so than ever. And we know there's aspects that work and that don't, but people still have all these biases to change, and we're just cognitive biases. So how do we help them overcome that so they can see the other side? And I think that we have to change in order to continue to grow our impact. That's just constant. You have to constantly be evolving. Okay. And sometimes you have to change faster than others, despite some challenges with that. But nobody likes change. And so I'm curious, like, what is, from a brain science standpoint, what are some of the inhibitors to people changing? What is causing the challenge for people to change? And then for those that are more flexible or Gumby-like with change, what do they have that others may not, in terms of a brain science standpoint?
Yeah. Change really impacts our brain in a negative way, because we don't know and we can't predict who we are going to be and what's going to happen on the other side of the change. So therefore, it's much easier to resist it and buckle down and simply say, not for me, it's for you. You change, I'll watch you, than it is to jump in. So what if we, as the people who are guiding the change, helped people talk through that resistance, that fear, and help them put words to it, so not only can they understand it, but we can understand them. And then when it comes down to change, many people think, well, I'm just going to make one big jump. No, we don't have to do that at all. If you see this as a change and you see how that will benefit you and you reaching your goals and you getting what you want, then how can I come along alongside with you to help you to do that? Versus simply saying, this is the change. Here's what you need to do. Here is how you need to do it. Now have at it. And then we wonder why people don't change. We wonder why they're not compliant, because we haven't tapped into their understanding and helped them to understand even themselves about what's in it for them. And that there are for it, and every decision has a consequence or an implication. What are those? Mm-hmm. And when we do that and talk through the change, talk through the implications, then we really tap into, are you willing to do this? I will help you, but first, are you willing to do it?
It really gets into a lot of things, I believe, in terms of what you, and I think you talk about it in your book, about co-creative and collaborative conversations and the idea of working together. Talk to us a little bit more about what that looks like and why that's so important to be not talking to, but talking with and collaborating with the client and the prospect.
I'm going to set that up a little bit because many of us are really good at what I call level one and level two conversations. We tell people what to do. We get a few pieces of information. Our brain goes, look at this split. I know how to solve the problem. And we tell people what to do. We tell them how to do it. And then the impact that has on other people, they're checked out. They don't trust you. Or we're smarter than the average. Where I know we ask a lot of good questions. You know, your 20 best favorite questions. You ask them and you ask them all. And now all of a sudden you say, oh, now I completely know what's going on. And I'm really confident that I know the answer. And so we tell people and we simply say, you know, given what you've said, and here's the data, here's the facts, here's the software, here's the charts, here's the graph, you would agree. And we monopolize the conversation. And we tell them everything that we need to know in order to persuade them that what we see and what we know is the right thing to do. Well, people shut down and they don't trust you. And it sounds like, well, give it all that I told you and all the facts and all the data. Oh, wait, yeah, let me add in some stories too about clients who didn't do this and what happened to them. Well, you've put the fear of God in them, the wrath of God in them, and they fear and they back down and they don't trust you. So persuading and telling people what to do doesn't work. However, what does is what I call a level three, the conversation, the co-creative conversation. And it's really very simple when you boil it down to its principles, is that we share, we care, and we connect. So let's boil that down. What does it mean? We share and discover. What are you thinking? Open-ended questions for which you have no answer. Not 100 of them, one or two, but it requires that you listen to what I've just said. And so your follow-up question is one that you don't have the answer for, such as, well, what was the impact for you? What happened then? What was that like for you?
Yeah.
Wow. You ask those kinds of questions, which I call our thinking questions, thinking/feeling questions. And all of a sudden you've opened up the other person's brain to really think about that. And as they're thinking about it, they think out loud and can share with you because you're right there to support them. You're not telling them or persuading them prematurely.
Mm-hmm.
We listen to their stories. We don't overshadow their stories because we've got a better one. We think, you know, that whole thing about like, just let me listen to you so that I understand. And then when it comes time and we have different ideas, you know what we do instead of jumping over them, you know, our brain hates it when people have different ideas because obviously we're right. We don't jump over it or we don't ignore it. We simply say, well, that's an interesting idea. Where did that come from? Matt, tell me, how did you come up with that? And those are the ways that we begin creating this partnership where I'm willing to listen to you. I'm willing to tell you the truth. I'm willing to go with you on your journey. Now, I am your guide and I'm not by any way minimizing the financial expertise that people have, not at all. But we have to put it in its proper perspective, and there's a time and place for everyone.
What is you're talking through that, and I'm victim of it a lot, and it's something that I've become aware of, and I'm still not great at, I'm still working on every single day, is this idea of, I say, listen to hear, not to fix. But I tend that that is what I have to keep reminding myself to do, yet I listen to hear, and I just had a meeting this morning about it with another team member. And I listened and I heard and I like right away, my mind went straight to fixing and solutioning in the brain. And why is it that we all tend to jump from hearing a problem and going straight to fixing? And maybe it's just a male thing. Maybe, I don't know, but I think it's a human thing. What is the cause of that so that we can then put the stopgap and the barrier in between to stop that, because it is so easy. And that's like the easy thing that you just are prone to doing all the time.
Right. It is an easy thing. And it's not, I believe it's not a male or female or gender or generational. It is how we are wired as human beings. You remember our brains were wired originally to protect us. So if we saw a problem, we had to fix it. And that kind of wiring has been through with us through ages. The other thing is the brain likes to know what to expect. And it loves to solve a problem. It doesn't like being left hanging, not knowing. And that's just the way that we're wired. And so when we're saying, I've like, listen to understand, not to fix, sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? So why don't you do it? Because your brain is triggering you all along the way. Fix it, fix it, fix it, fix it. You know the answer. Tell the answer. monopolize the conversation. Talk, talk, talk until you can't talk anymore. That's the way that we're wired, which is why it's difficult to change, because we have to catch up. First of all, we have to be aware of it. And when we know that this is the way that our brain works, we have to self-manage over that. And so when we're in a situation and someone is telling us a problem, I encourage people to get one or two go-to statements that simply say, when I hear that I want to fix it, I stop and say, what else is there? Or what have you thought about? So we have to stop ourselves from telling to being more curious. See, yeah. That's the thing of our brain, that curiosity and judgment live in different parts of the brain. I can judge and I can know, because that's my limbic system. It's responding to fear or threat or not knowing. Now, when I get curious, I open up the prefrontal cortex. And it's a matter of being really aware of that and practicing it and having a guide and a teacher like myself to help you with that. Or you could even help the people that you work with and just tape a conversation and go back and look at it and simply say, do I see now how I'm always solving other people's problems, rather than simply saying, and what will you like to do with that? What are your thoughts about it? What are your ideas? It's about turning it from ourselves to the other person.
Yeah, I think that mentality of curiosity is so key, right? I think that, yes. You know, and I know that, you know, Shane Parrish in the book Clear Thinking, he talks about how it's a matter of helping overcome, you know, emotions, etc. It's about thoughtful questions. And the only way to have thoughtful questions is to be intently listening. And the only way to keep intently listening is to be naturally curious in what other people have to say and not think you know all the answers. And so it all moves together. And I'm not saying that it has to be there all the time or you're going to succeed at it 100% of the time, but being aware of it and being able to say to yourself, well, you know, I didn't really do it great last time. I'm going to try to do it better this time. And you'll start to see these small tweaks of your relationship being stronger. If you look at your best relationships, it's because you're actually curious about them, right? I'm very curious about my spouse, and that's how we got together. We were curious about learning about each other, and you build the best relationships with those that you're curious with and that you're able to do consistently on. Now, I want to drive to something else, and I just mentioned emotions. And, you know, I think that there's two drivers with regards to money that advisors have to deal with that I think then goes to the brain. And it's emotions and it's status. And, you know, I think when you think about emotions, as you're dealing with someone, I think that advisors, we tend to go to the data, the rationale, this is right, it works. But, you know, what you tend to see, and Shane Parrish talks about this in Clear Thinking very heavily, is that as someone's emotions ramp up over a situation, the impact that facts and data and rationalization have on it start to become decreasing, they diminishing returns, right, from that standpoint.
Yes.
And then you have this other aspect of, you know, when you're dealing with a client, you try to learn as much as you can, but there's other influences in their life that you may not know about, especially their social circle and the status they have. And so when you're telling someone maybe to not buy a new car or not buy the boat because it's not financially feasible or X, Y, and Z in the data, they hear that as, my friends are going to judge me. I don't want to put my status at risk, so I'm not going to do it. And they go do it, and you're like, well, why did you do it? And you know it's keeping up with the Joneses. But that's a challenge, both emotions, which are hard to control, and social circle, which you have no control over. And so when you think about that from the psychology aspect of helping to nudge individuals and families closer to doing what you perceive as right because you're coming from a different view, vantage point, how do we overcome that? How do we overcome those drivers that are so far out of our control? And it's somewhat out of our client's control because they don't even know that they're acting that way. And if you tell them, they're not going to your point, they're not going to care. So how do we help with that?
So first of all, I would never tell, and I would nudge them by asking really curious questions, such as, so you want to buy this new boat? Okay, tell me about that. And we get the specs out, and it's this, and it's this, this. You know, client, I have a, I'm just curious. What will that give you? They'll tell you. What will that give you? How will that help you to reach the things that are important to you? We go around it rather than telling people what to do. We go around it to help them think through what it is that they're saying, what it is that they believe, what it is that they're feeling, so that they can hear themselves talk. Because many times when we talk ourselves, when we talk through it, literally on a level that I can hear what you're saying and you could hear what I'm saying, we have sort of this aha moment, like, oh my gosh, I never realized that before. So all my friends are buying this big 60-foot yacht. I want one too. Okay, so you want one. That's okay. Well, how will that help you? How will that give you what you want? How will that influence you? What's that all about? I'm not telling you you can't, because clients are going to do what they're going to do anyway, whether it's in their best interest or not. And our job is not to tell them no, but to help them think through the decisions that they're making. We become their thinking partner. And I'm telling you, this is one thing I know for sure, and I will stand at: a thinking partner becomes a trusted partner. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And so if I can think through that, and you can simply say, okay, so you've thought about that. Have you thought about this? And what would be the impact of that? Have you thought about this? Because you're ultimately going to decide. And if you make this decision, how else will that show up? Let's just talk through it. Yeah. And as far as emotions are beautiful data if we know how to handle them. They tell us everything that we want to know about a person. And if we listen for those emotions and say to them, what does that mean to you? Or how does that show up for you? What did you learn from that? Where did you learn that? What's been the impact? And tap into helping to understand those emotions. Once again, the client will express. They will express. And you're allowing them, you're helping them to express. And by doing that, you have on the table data and information and feelings and desires and hopes and aspirations that you can work with. The problem is we go around it because we're not very comfortable having those kinds of conversations. And when we go around it or over it, you know where it goes? Underneath the table. And it doesn't help anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love the idea of being a thinking partner. I think that's incredible. And to be a thinking partner, you have to be great at asking great questions. And I think that advisors naturally are good at asking questions. I think that sometimes we may rush quicker than not to a solution. Yeah. But I'm curious from your perspective, because like you're asking some of these questions like of scenario and role playing, but you've done this for a long period of time. And sometimes when you just get in the moment, it's hard to think of some of these questions. You're like, yeah, of course I should have asked that. Or yes, I should ask that. What makes a question from your perspective a great question?
A great question is one that you don't know the answer to.
And I didn't know the answer. Actually, I had a different answer. So does that make it not a great question? My question that I just asked, I had a different answer than what you gave. Does that make it? Well, it was that a great question is a question that is using the information that has been heard or said by the other person. But it's an intentional question as opposed to it's a collaborative question to your point of collaborative solutioning, thinking, et cetera, from there.
Yeah. We're co-creating right here in front of our eyes. Because I would say that it's a question that you don't know the answer for. However, it must be in context of what the client just told you, which makes it relevant, and it needs to be specific.
Yeah.
But when you put that together, you end up with a question that spurs people to think. And when you listen to what they think, you're beginning to co-create together, because it's not that your idea is the best or that my idea is the best. We'd like to think that. Not true. Your idea stands by itself in its own merit, but so does mine. But man, if we can really listen to each other and explore and ask questions that are relevant and specific to what we're talking about, we put them together and we come up with something perhaps that neither one of us thought about. That's co-creation.
I love that. That wasn't planned. Look at that. We just did that on the spot. Look at that. I want to switch for 1 second, and then I want to dive back into some of the things that you mentioned from your book and also in some other podcasts that I've listened to of yours is... I'm just curious. You know, I'm fortunate to be able to talk to a good bit of psychologists and brain scientists, et cetera. But what makes money so emotional to people? What's the cause of people being so emotional around money, their finances? Is it? Well, I'll just leave it open ended.
I have a hypothesis.
Fair enough. That's all we can do.
That is incredibly emotional because ingrained in our memory banks. In our brain, our long-term memory banks, we have had stories, history, experiences that we didn't necessarily understand, but we remember. And so based on that, we sort of put them in our memory bank. We don't think much about them. And then they pop up at the least convenient time. So I'm thinking about one of the stories of my childhood is when Billy had to move because his dad lost his job and they had to move. Well, why did they have to move? Because they don't have any money. So my association and the in a small world and in undeveloped brain, money was bad because it made you had to move. Mm. So we have all sorts of stories and associations, but we never really take a lot of time to explore our relationship with money and where some of these thoughts and stories come from. So when they come up in adult conversations, or they come up when we're talking with our financial planner or our partner, or even in business and we're making business decisions that are around money, we get triggered and we don't even know why. Because money is emotional. It reminds us of the things that we learned, the stories that we've heard, the beliefs that we've developed, the assumptions that we've made, which all then go into the biases that we already have.
Hmm.
Because this is not a conversation that's been a conversation until actually recently.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. As you're talking, you know, and you talked about Billy having to move, and having to move means he had no money, and then that association, and I don't want to go there. You know, I think that a lot of people can say, you know, if you see a homeless person, right, you say, well, that's not me. And we associate that, you know, losing money on an investment or losing a job, that then that's the next alternative. But there's like 14, 50, 100 layers, I don't know, until you get to that point. There's other circumstances that led to that person. You know, just like I was talking in a previous podcast to someone about brand, and everybody looks at when they want to build their personal brand, they look at someone that's been doing it and being like, they try to do those tactics, but there's so much that happened in between. Same thing on the other side, the negative side. And I feel, just from what you're saying as I listened, was that we all hold so tightly to money so that we don't go to this thing, which we all know that if we hold so tightly to something, that we tend to, that's actually not the best situation. When you hold so tightly, it causes you to lose vision. You get, you narrow-minded, you make bad decisions because you're fearful, not open-minded and understanding. And that's, I think, a driver of why people make bad decisions, emotional decisions with their money, is that we think that if we hold tightly to it, because we don't want that, you know, we don't want to be like Billy when we were growing up, that we think that's going to be better for us. But in reality, many studies have shown that that's actually a detriment.
It is a detriment to making decisions. And imagine now that you're the financial person, the financial professional dealing with me, and I have these ideas about Billy and his money, and I'm fearful. What if you could tap into that and simply say, wow, you know, what have you learned that along the way? What have you learned about money? Very different than tell me your money story. You're getting to the same thing, but it's always with the focus of the client and asking them questions that either allow them to answer or not answer. And when you ask, I call them gentle questions, questions for which you're not asked. When you ask these gentle questions, they can begin to consider other things. Because you, the financial professional, know about all these things. And when I'm fearful, I do not make good decisions. I might not even tell you about those decisions that I make because I'm fearful. So how do we take that fear and minimize that and replace it with, we can talk about anything?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's super interesting because I think that when advisors listen to my conversations on the podcast that I have, or anybody, listeners listen to podcasts that we have when we have psychologists or behavioral finance experts on, et cetera, is the end result always comes to us as advisors need to be more like psychologists and psychiatrists and asking therapeutic types questions. I think about, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy and like asking these types of questions that get deeper, that make us feel uncomfortable, that make us feel that we're not doing our job because it's outside our scope. But in reality, that is the job. And it's an uncomfortable feeling that we all have to overcome, because those types of questions are necessary to help us do our job to the best of our ability for the client.
And you're just such a wealth of information. I say financial professionals are wicked smart. They're so, so smart. And how can we help you to take all this smartness that you have and all the different things that you've studied and all the different things you know, and help you to translate that to leading conversations where you can ask your clients the kinds of things that will help them to open up to you.
Mm-hmm. That's so good. Well, I want to be cognizant of your time, but before we do, there's one other aspect that I took away from a podcast you're on with a mutual friend of ours, Matt Holleran. And and you mentioned something in there. You were talking about the $1 million opener, which we alluded to, but you also mentioned a concept called the golden minute. I'd love for you to tell our listeners a little bit more about the golden minute.
I love the golden minute. You have less than a minute to capture the attention of the person that you're speaking to. This is your golden minute. Now you can open up your conversation and do whatever you want, but what can you do to make it really special so that they want to pay attention to you, that you capture their attention so that you draw them into you? And my solution to that? Create that emotional connection right off the bat. The golden minute is like, so happy to see you. I'm glad that we can spend this time together. You know what that's done, Matt, to my brain? Ding, ding, the prefrontal cortex. And then we follow up like, what's personal before business? Always. What's been going on in your world? Okay. It's going to, what's important that we talk about today? Okay, great. Now you've just touched my brain in a really positive way in that golden minute, 1 to 3 minutes. You've welcomed me. You've made me feel safe. You've made me feel warm. We know that what we're going to talk about and why we're going to talk about it. You invited me into the conversation. And that is, in essence, how we do it. We've just co-created the beginning roadmap of our conversation. But it's not about me telling you. It's about you and I making it together. That's golden. That is pure gold. And the way when you do that, I am telling you, I know and have experienced, I've felt it, I teach it. When you do that, people are just, they don't know what you're doing. They don't really care why you're doing it, but you know what they do know? Wow, that feels good. And when it feels good, you've just tapped into the prefrontal cortex to open it up so that we can begin, continue the connection.
Yeah, that's incredible. I love that. Now I see why you like it so much. And we'd be able to talk for hours, I think. But I like I said, I want to be cognizant of time. This has been super interesting. I mean, I've learned a ton off of this. But before I let you go, I need to ask you the two questions I ask all my guests. And the first one is, you know, to quench my thirst of curiosity, I always like to learn through people that are smarter than me, like yourself. And I like to do that through reading. So I always ask my guests, what's one book out there that you think outside of yours, which we already know we can go and get, what's one book out there that you think everybody should read, or if they've already read it, they should reread it again?
Leading with Your Upper Brain. Leading with Your Upper Brain by Michael and Robert Frisana. And what I love about that book, of course, it's neuroscience based, evidence based, and apply to leadership. And it really shows us how when we connect with people, we can really help them develop their potential.
I love that.
And as a leader, and we're all leaders, Matt, we're leaders in our business, we're leaders with our staff, we're leaders with our loved ones, we're leaders in our community, we're leaders everywhere that we go. Our effectiveness has very little to do with our personality and a whole lot to do with the behaviors that we show and the actions that we take.
I love that. I actually have not heard of that one yet. So that's going to come on my bookshelf here soon to get read in a very short order. The last question, we talked about a ton here, and whether it's about something we talked about in this podcast or something that we didn't touch on, but what's one piece of actionable advice that you think would be great for our listeners that they could implement today or tomorrow and better themselves, their business, their clients, their family, whatever it may be? What would be your one piece?
The one piece of advice that I would give, and I live by this, whenever I get in stuck or get into trouble or get into a problem that I can't seem that I solve, this is my go-to statement from Wayne Dyer. If you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Not only does it flip the script and open up our prefrontal cortex, it really helps us, which then allows us to see possibilities. And so when you consider and applying that to what we've talked about today in conversations that build trust, consider that. What if you flipped the script and the client really was the center of the conversation and everything around it? you and your financial expertise and your skills and your talents and all the things that you bring supported and was complementary to your client. What would happen? I think that you'd have a very confident client who knows why they're making decisions and that the decisions are the best ones at the time. You would have empowered people making the good decisions. And I will guarantee you that they will never go anywhere else. You have just made a lifelong partnership that stands the test of time.
I love that. Mary Schmidt, you've been incredible. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I've learned a lot. I'm inspired by what you do. I'm excited to continue to follow you and your journey. What's the best way for others to continue to follow your journey, to stay in touch, to get in touch, potentially work with you, whatever it may be? What's the best way?
Yeah, there's two ways. First of all, LinkedIn. Connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm always on LinkedIn. About every 3 weeks or so, I post another quick video about conversations. So connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm always happy to connect with you. I have a special report, if people are interested in this, called Lead with Trust Now. And it really outlines exactly what we've talked about. And if people would be interested in that special report, they can certainly go to leadwithtrust.com and get it.
I love it. Mary Schmidt, you're incredible. I really appreciate you. I appreciate this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay well, be well, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thank you, Matt. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Bridging the Gap. Don't forget to give us a rating and let us know what you think.